Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Okay, thanks for joining us on Fire Marshal's Corner here on Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamel, and this month we're going international again. First, before we do, though, we're going to start on this side of the Atlantic with a segment from the National Association of State Fire Marshals featuring New Hampshire Fire Marshal Bill Degnan. Marshal Degnan will be covering some of the information about alternative heating fire safety, which is really a timely topic as we move into the winter season here in the United States. We then move over to the United Kingdom for a talk with Philip Hayes, who's the head of community fire safety for the Cheshire Fire and Rescue Services over in the United Kingdom. Fire Service in the UK adopted a really radically new approach to prevention and safety in 2002 that is really a lot more risk-based. And Phil's going to provide us with a great overview of how it is working and what possible lessons we can get from it here in the United States. Then we're going to move on and talk to Dr. Jim Marsden from the Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Services, again in the UK, for a discussion on the environmental impacts of fire and how it is contributing to global warming. This is an effort and research program that is very much in the initial stages, and Dr. Marsden has been working on efforts to quantify how much structural fires are contributing to global warming and the role of fire safety in developing a more sustainable community, not only in the UK, but across the globe. So, let's sit back and listen to Fire Marshal's Corner on Radio at Firehouse.com.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And today on Fire Marshal's Corner on Radio at Firehouse.com, we're joined by New Hampshire State Fire Marshal Bill Degnan. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Well, thank you for having me, Ed.
Mm-hmm. Bill's going to be talking to us about alternative heating safety. As we move into the winter months, we're going to start getting a lot of different forms of heating being used, wood stoves, kerosene heaters, and of course we're going to see all the fires go up as a result of this, unfortunately. So, Bill, I was wondering if you had any tips or suggestions or ideas on alternative heating safety that people should be using.
Well, you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, during this time of year, we do see a rise in the amount of fires that involve heating devices. And, you know, the major cause of these is portable and space heaters that are left unattended, different things with, like, fueling errors in how they fuel up their kerosene-type heaters. And, how a unit's designed and how it's installed and used is also a critical factor. And one of the most common causes is easily eliminated is people putting things in combustible items too close to portable space heaters. You know, these are all some of the basics that you have to take a look at. And if you look at them, especially like with wood heaters and wood stoves and fireplaces, usually you find that the lack of regular cleaning on the chimneys is a major problem, and the chimney fires will damage the chimney and it extends out into the home, and as well as items being placed too close to them. You know, children around a wood heater might place toys or other combustible items up against it, and we hope that the people don't put their wood next to it in order to dry it out. Unfortunately, we've seen that in many cases.
And the problem with the creosote buildup, too, is the creosote's very combustible, isn't it, inside the chimney?
Yes, the creosote is. It's basically burns like a petroleum product.
How frequently should a chimney be cleaned out and inspected?
Well, it should be checked at least every 3 or 4 weeks if you're using it on a regular basis. And at least once per day, the fire should be brought up to a higher temperature so that it heats up the creosote and gets it off of the chimney liner before it gets up to a thick buildup.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're going to get creosote no matter what, aren't you? I mean, it's just one of the things of when you're burning wood, it builds up in there no matter what.
Yes, that's one of the things of burning wood, and usually you'll get additional creosote buildup if the wood is not dry or if you're using a soft wood, or in times where the wood stoves are they're so efficient now that if you tighten down the air handling going into the wood stove, it creates a system that is not completely burning everything as the products of combustion are given off, and so that leaves more creosote in the chimney.
You'd also mentioned the portable space heaters. I mean, boy, that just seems to be time and again we see those fires. And you mentioned the kids, too. I mean, the biggest tragedy I probably saw is when parents are placing them close to a crib to try to keep the child warm during the night, and then you get the fire break out. You know, is there kind of a recommended distance that you should keep clear around a portable space heater?
36 inches is the recommended distance on any of these units. And, you know, you have a very good point. They're trying to heat a space, and they're not intended to heat a whole room. But they are good at heating small spaces, but they always should be plugged directly into the outlet and only used for what their design capabilities are. They're not intended to be run 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other factors that we see quite often is people put them on extension cords, and it usually fails right where the heater plugs into the extension cord. Right. It softens and then ignites right there.
Because these things just draw a tremendous amount of power, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yeah. And don't they have tip-over switches in them now, too? You see these long, tall, skinny ones. If they tip over, don't they automatically shut off?
Yes. The electric heaters that are produced today all have safety switches, which do turn them off when tipped over. Another thing for the consumer to take a look at is also to ensure that they're listed by a recognized testing laboratory, such as Underwriters Laboratory.
Good point. Excellent point. You mentioned kerosene heaters. What are some of the safety tips that people should be taking with kerosene?
Kerosene heaters are also another unit that the first thing you should check is to see that it has a recognized testing laboratory label, such as UL. But you always want to use the clear kerosene, the K1. And that should be stored in a container that's clearly marked for use for kerosene. So there's no chance that you're going to take the red can that might have gasoline in it and put it into your kerosene heater. In following the manufacturer's recommendations on ventilation is probably the most significant part of the use of this for your health and safety, because in most of the manufacturer's recommendations it says that you need to have air exchanges in that room, and they recommend that you keep a window or a door slightly open in order to get fresh air coming in.
Which probably a lot of people aren't going to do, because that just lets the cold air in then when they do that sort of thing, right?
Yes, and that's the unfortunate side of it, because they do give off products of combustion. In any of the cases, if you have a kerosene heater or a gas heater or any of those, I'd recommend a carbon monoxide alarm in your home as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's just, we're seeing more and more of those come into play, but we're also seeing the number of incidents, too, of carbon monoxide poisoning.
Definitely.
But the CO detectors have absolutely been just such a boon in terms of, you know, saving lives. An excellent point.
You know, one of the other issues that we see with the kerosene heaters is that people will fill them inside the home when they're still warm. They need to be taken outside.
What else do we have for heating fire safety? I mean, what's some of the other things that you've seen out there in all your years of experience?
Well, one of the things that we're seeing coming in now is the propane and natural gas fired parlor stoves. And they give off a real nice glow. It looks just like a regular fireplace or a wood stove. And many people are putting in the unvented ones, you know, or vent-free, as some of the advertisements call them. If you're using something like a vent-free unit, again, the manufacturer's specifications come into play, and they're so important. And one of the things that people really don't understand, and we hear this comment quite often on the vent-free, is how much moisture gets put into the air when you use a vent-free unit. In the home. It increases the moisture inside the home tremendously. They do have oxygen depletion sensors on them that they are designed to shut off the unit if the oxygen gets down to 18% in the room.
That's interesting. Quite honestly, I had not really heard of those units, and I'll have to take a little bit more of a look at them, because that's something that's new to me, but I'm sure there are a lot of people out there using them.
In any case, whether it's a vented unit or an unvented unit, following the installation instructions on how you install it, and the gas needs to be piped by a qualified technician because they're required to test the line before they power up the heating unit to ensure that there's no leaks and you don't have gas coming into your home.
Right.
And also that if it's a vented unit, that it's vented appropriately using the proper chimney.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add in terms of heating safety as we move into the cold winter months here?
Well, one of the other things that's often forgot is the people with their heating system, whether it's oil or gas, you know, for their home heating. It can be forced hot water heat or it can be forced hot air heat. And it's the maintenance of those units, making sure that they're cleaned every year, making sure that they're tuned up so they're running efficiently, because if it's running efficiently, it's going to produce less byproducts of combustion, mm-hmm. which is what's harmful to both you as an individual and the atmosphere.
Right. And no matter what kind of heating system you have in there, you had mentioned CO detectors and, of course, smoke alarms. Everybody should have smoke alarms. They should test them, should maintain them, never remove the batteries. I mean, we say it time and again, but you keep seeing it happen time and again, don't you?
Absolutely. And to have them interconnected on every level of the home mm-hmm. is so important. Because think of it, if you have a fire start in the basement of the home and you're on the second floor, what's the chances of you hearing that smoke alarm if it goes off in the basement?
I mean, I agree with you. And now with the wireless smoke alarms that they have out there on the market, it's even easier to do nowadays.
It makes it so easy for people to upgrade, you know, their protection in the home. Yeah. And to be able to have them interconnected, it gives that early warning so you can get out of that home in time.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're also always recommending, if you have the opportunity, put residential sprinklers in your home.
Absolutely. I mean, that's
they save lives.
They save lives. There is no two ways about that. Yep. Well, we've been talking with Fire Marshal Bill Degnan from New Hampshire about heating fire safety as we're getting ready for the winter months here. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us, Bill.
Well, thank you, Ed.
You've been listening to Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Kamau.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, this is Ed Kamau from Radio at firehouse.com here on Fire Marshal's Corner. And today we're talking with Philip Hayes, who's the head of community fire services with the Cheshire Fire and Rescue Services over in the United Kingdom. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
That's no problem, Ed. I'm delighted to talk to you.
Phil and I met a few weeks ago when I was over there in London attending Summit 2007, which took a look at how the British Fire Service is approaching fire safety. They're doing what they call an integrated risk management approach, which I found absolutely fascinating and something that we're just not really doing here widespread in the United States. And so I invited Phil to come on and kind of fill us in on how it's been working for them, because when it first started in 2002, that was a pretty major change for the fire service, wasn't it, Phil?
It was, yeah. I think back in 2002, there was a review done into the fire service in the United Kingdom. Part of that review focused very much on the sort of risk management elements. I mean, we'd been operating with standards of fire cover, which were set in 1947, and nothing much had changed. I think the time had come to change the fire service to be more proactive in the way we went about our business.
And those standards of fire cover were pretty much time-driven, weren't they? You had to have so much apparatus there within a certain period of time. Wasn't that how they were laid out?
They were, yeah. There was different risk categories ranging from sort of A risk through B risk, C risk, D risk. And there were different times of response that you were required to achieve as a fire service. A D risk would have been a rural risk, so it would be quite a rural community, and your time in attendance might be 20 minutes. Whereas an A risk, which would be more of a heavily built-up area, quite an industrial area, your time would be 3 fire engines in less than 8 minutes. And so there was quite a discrepancy in the times. And one of the problems with the standards of fire cover were that they hadn't accounted for the population, if you like, had moved. And when you go back to after the Second World War, when these standards were first thought about, most of the people lived in the big cities. They lived very close to where the industry was. And if we're going to talk about life safety as opposed to saving property, then a lot of the people have moved, and people don't necessarily live where they work. There's a much more mobile society. And it certainly wasn't a one-size-fits-all, didn't work anymore.
So what are some of the changes that happened in 2002? What did they call for to be different?
Well, there was a lot went on in 2002, and I think the big focus, there was some industrial action by the fire service during that time. And there was the firefighters, there was a call for an increase in pay for firefighters. Part of the whole package was that firefighters, there was going to be an increase in pay, and people, there was going to be a review of their conditions, but there had to be something given back for that. And part of that package was this move to a risk-based approach. So rather than having a sort of the one-size-fits-all and that's the way you do it, and there's no flexibility in that, which was the fire standards of fire cover, was that you looked at the risk in your community. So each fire service in each county needed to analyse the risk that it had in its community, and then it would devise appropriate response standards to that risk.
So how do you go about evaluating the risk in your community?
Well, there's a number of tools that have come on the market. One is called the Fire Services Emergency Cover Model, which is computer-based software, which analyses where the property is, it analyses where the population is, and there's lots of other risk factors, you know, chemical and petrol industry in Cheshire in the county that I work, and that's all thrown into the mixing pot. And then you look at where your fire stations are actually placed, your existing fire stations, and when you mix all that up, what you actually do is you get out a risk pattern, if you like, a risk profile for your county, and from that risk profile, you can work out what response you need for those premises.
Now, it sounds like a lot of that is property or occupancy-driven. Aren't you looking at some of the demographics of the community as well?
Yeah, we are. And one of the things, where we're actually having our problems, I mean, the fire safety legislation in the United Kingdom has been very much driven and focused around commercial properties. So sort of offices, theatres, over time legislation has grown up because of various incidents. I mean, you know, the railways, I mean, there's all sorts of legislation that's actually had a big impact on the number of people that die in commercial properties, and we have very few fire deaths in non-domestic dwellings now. I mean, we've got the number really, really down, but we're still getting a lot of people who die in fires actually in dwellings, and something like 80% of fire deaths in the United Kingdom are in dwellings. And that's the area where we don't actually have any legislation to go into into a person's home. And, you know, an Englishman's home is still his castle. Mm-hmm. And there's no legislation. There's some building regulations for new builds, which requires the fitting of hardwired smoke alarms. But back in sort of 1988, I think the smoke alarm ownership in properties in the United Kingdom was something like 8%, you know, if properties had a smoke alarm in. And one of the things that was identified through the review in 2002 that was community safety, in other words, the fire service getting out into the community and educating them on the dangers of fire in the home, that had got to be a key part of any risk management that you did. And from that, we've developed that we actually now look at the demographics of our community. So we know the areas where we have the most accidental dwelling fires, and we know where the people with the sort of lowest social profile and where the demography sort of dictates that there are social problems, and we know that those are the areas we need to concentrate on. So we try and hit those areas with community safety and community engagement.
Now, I recall from our conversation too, you have quite a mixture of ethnic groups and different nationalities in your area there, don't you?
Yeah, we do. I mean, Cheshire's quite a rural county. We've got a few big towns, and we've got the city of Chester in the county. Like I say, we've got the second biggest petrochemical manufacturing base in the country. So we've got a huge commercial pot there. We've also got, you know, we've got a lot of green fields in Cheshire, and it's a very rural county with a big farming community. So we've got a mix of everything. As regards diversity goes, we don't, you know, we have pockets of minority groups in Cheshire from the different BME groups, but we do have some big minority groups in likes of the Gypsy Travel community. We've got a big migrant population of Eastern European people who are coming over and living in Cheshire and working in Cheshire, and those all create their own issues with, again, the way they live and the way they work, and again, they tend to live in the areas where we're having the most accidental dwelling fires. So it's actually engaging with those communities as well. So we have like a Polish volunteer who works for us now, and that person's role is purely communicating with the Polish community and speaking with them and trying to get our fire safety message over to those communities.
Now, you're using more than just the fire service for this outreach too. Aren't you partnering with other social organizations and departments to try to reach out to people?
Yeah, we are. Well, one of the things through the intelligence that we've got, one of the things we've identified is that our at-risk group is not only our at-risk group, it's also the at-risk group for the health service, for social services, and a number of other agencies. And we've just sort of started a data sharing protocol with the health authorities. So the PCTs, the health people who govern the health boards, we're actually sharing information with them, and we're just on the verge of getting 165,000 sets of data from the health service, which is all people who are over 65 who are registered as vulnerable people in Cheshire. Now, what we intend to do with that data set over a couple of years is to actually visit all those people that we haven't already visited, some of them we will have visited to. So there's some data cleansing that needs to go on in sorting that data out. But what we do know is that a lot of those people, those older vulnerable people, need us to go and speak to them about fire safety in the home. You know, we have a very few fire deaths in Cheshire. We average about 3 fire deaths, but since I think when we met a few weeks ago, we just had an elderly person died in a fire, and we actually had another one last week. So we've actually had 2 people die in fires in the last couple of weeks, and they were both pensioners, they were both living alone, and they sit right into this profile of people that we know we're going to have our fire deaths with. So the fact that we can share this data with the health authorities, and we can share data with social services, and they identify to us people that they think we ought to go and talk to about fire safety because there is a risk to that person. But on the reverse of that, when we go into a home, we do what's called a contact assessment, and if we visit a home with an elderly person, and we might give them advice about fire safety, about we will put some 3 smoke alarms up for them, we will explain to them about turning things off at night, we'll talk about, we'll check their electric blankets if they've got them, and if they've got a chip pan, we'll change that for a defat fryer, and we give them lots of fire safety advice. But if we think that they need support in other areas, for example, they might need support in filling some forms out for social services to get pensions or whatever, then we will actually notify the other agencies that this person needs some support with the consent of the person. So there's no, you know, we're not sort of, if you like, telling agencies tales about people if they don't want to, because it's all done with consent of the person. And then the other agencies go in and support those people, and that is very well received, and we're getting this partnership approach of not just the fire service, but a number of public bodies and government agencies all working to sort of improve the quality of life for these people.
Now, after you have the unfortunate tragedies you just mentioned, where you had 2 elderly people that were killed,
yeah,
do you do a campaign in response to that to try to further raise the awareness?
We do. I think the campaign inside is very difficult, and in particular, one of the 2 that I went out to, I went to one of the incidents, and the person, this elderly chap, he'd actually got family who lived in the area very close to him, and so to go in and do a campaign straight away, it is quite insensitive, and it doesn't help with the family. But what we do is we will do a full investigation, as you do with any fire, and we will look into the causes. We have to wait, obviously, for the coroner's reports to come back to establish that these incidents are, it is a fire death and there's not been another cause of death. And then when the time is right, then we will actually go back into that community and we will actually go and speak to people. We'll engage with the community, we'll talk about fire safety in that community. Sometimes if we have a house fire and there's nobody injured or nobody died, then we will straight away, we'll seize the moment, and we will actually go out into that community the very next day or even that night and actually go and speak to people, and we'll hit the community quite hard with the fire safety message, because one thing a fire does if you have a fire in the street or on your estate or in your cul-de-sac, one thing the fire does, it brings everybody out to look at it, so we capture that moment, and we will use that to hammer home the message about, you need to have smoke alarms, you need to shut your doors at night. If you have a fire, ring us up straight away and don't try and deal with it yourself. So there's a whole host of messages, but we try and seize the moment. But like I say, when we've had a fatal fire, it's sometimes not sensitive to do that, so we just have to plan that quite carefully.
Given the different minority groups you might have in a community or the different demographics, do you have to tweak your message or change your message to reach these different demographics?
We do, to some degree. We do have different languages. So, for example, we've got the sort of Chinese New Year coming up, or a Muslim festival or a Hindu festival, we will give out leaflets in various languages, so we get different languages and different leaflets for people so they read it with the message we want to get over. We find that the message we're looking at the moment, as an example, is we've noticed over the last 6 months that we've had quite a large increase in grill pan and unattended cooker fires. There used to be chip pan fires. Over the last few years, we've sort of had a ban the pan campaign, and we've actually bought, and we've, our social services paid for a lot of deep fat fryers for people, and we've been really proactive in getting people to throw open chip pans away and replace them with proper deep fat fryers, which are thermostatically controlled, and we've been really successful with that. What we have noticed now is an increase in grill pan fires and unattended cooker fires. So we've got, over half, in fact I think it's nearer something like 70-odd% of the fires we get at the moment are caused by unattended cookers. So we're just about to launch on the 12th of December a Your Grill Can Kill campaign. So it's not aimed at a specific group, minority group. It's aimed at, right across the groups, but we've recognised that we need to up the campaign. So we'll have a big, on the 12th of December, there'll be a big launch of this Your Grill Can Kill campaign. There'll be big banners on all the fire stations across the county. They'll all have the same banner on. We've got thousands of cards and leaflets that will be all given out and posted out and put in post offices and places where the community go. And there'll be loads of press releases, and we'll do interviews on the radio. So it'll be that big impact. Mm-hmm. And get that message in, because we know there's an issue at the moment with these unattended cooker fires. So it might be that, you know, that we hope the whole idea is to drive those type of incidents down, but it might be that they're replaced with something else, you know, in a few months' time. So we might have to revisit that message, and we'll relaunch a new message of whatever's current at the time.
Well, that sounds like an incredibly aggressive campaign. You know, about how many of those would you say you do in a year?
Well, we've done it recently. We've done the government, the communities and local government, the government department, which oversees the fire service in the United Kingdom. They run seasonal campaigns. So when we have the run up to Christmas, there'll be a safety campaign at Christmas, focusing around electric lights and overloading sockets and the type of stuff you associate with the season. In the summer, we'll focus on barbecue fires and outdoor fires and safe that. Then the bonfire night in November, when we have all the fireworks, we focus on fireworks safety. In the summer, if it's a very dry summer, we do a lot of work around grass fires and people going out in the countryside and camping. So there's a whole host of messages that we can actually put throughout the year. In the past, we've put a message out, and then, you know, every few months we'll actually change that message over. But what I'm trying to do, and certainly over the next couple of years in Cheshire, is to have a big impact and a big launch on a more regular basis. So rather than the message of the community safety message becoming like a stale message, you know, you want to hit the county, give them a big message, and then maybe in 6 weeks, 2 months maximum, is what's your next message going to be? And again, a massive launch, big profile in all the press, on the radios, banners on the fire stations, and get the message out in the community. And if you do that regular, then you get those different messages over. If you do a message and then leave it 6 months, you know, it doesn't take long for people to sort of not take as much notice of it.
Now, you'd mentioned that you've had 3 fire fatalities in a year.
Yeah.
Which is a record that here in the United States, you know, many, many people would be very enviable of that.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty big reduction, too, from what you've had in the past, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We've had, in Cheshire, we've been pretty steady with our fire deaths. The fire death nationally is probably a better indicator of the way community safety is actually working. And I think when you look at the comparison between smoke alarm ownership and fire deaths, as I said earlier, in 1988, there was 8% of people had a smoke alarm in the country, and in 2005 it was 80%.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a massive increase, and also in 2005 it was the lowest fire deaths in the country since 1959. So that increase in community safety has contributed directly to, we believe has contributed directly to, a decrease in the number of fire deaths in the country. And the national average is about 8 people per million. And there's like 60 million population, so that's where the national average sits. So we're quite proud that in Cheshire we're actually on 3 deaths. We've got a million population in Cheshire, so we're on 3 deaths, which is well below the national average in fire deaths.
That is something to be very proud of.
Yeah.
Now, what you're doing in Cheshire, is that unique to your community, or is that something, you know, are other counties across the country doing similar type programs?
No, they are. It is part of the national framework for the fire and rescue services, and one of the outcomes of the review in 2002 was that, you know, fire services, community safety had always been something that had been talked about, but it had never been put on official footing. And now we have a legal duty to actually do community safety and work in the communities. We don't have a choice in that. We don't really want a choice in that, because we do want to do it. In Cheshire this year, there's 24 fire stations in Cheshire, of which 10 of those are part-time fire stations or retained, and the rest are fully staffed whole-time stations. We've got a target this year. We're probably going to hit 50,000 home safety assessments, so we'll actually do 50,000 visits this year into homes to do a safety assessment. Now, that's a big figure for us as a small organisation, but that's replicated across the country, and all over the country you'll see fire services going into thousands of homes and doing safety assessments and doing community safety events, and it is the national trend, and it's certainly having an impact, and the face of the fire service has changed in the country. You know, I mean, you go back a few years to where the fire service, if you weren't actually going out to fires, you'd be sat in your fire station, or you'd be doing some training, you'd be at an exercise, you know, all the traditional fiery things, if you like. Now, the fire engines are very rarely on the fire stations during the daytime because they're always out in the community, and we expect to see them out in the community. The training, we've had to realign the way that we work, so a lot of the training and the development and the operational training that firefighters have to do takes place in the evenings rather than in the daytime. But we think we've got the balance right now. The approaches that we're using, we've got more sophisticated at delivering the home safety assessment. So when we first launched it, we had like an 0800, a free phone number where people would ring up and say, you know, can you come and do a home safety assessment? And what we found was we had fire engines driving all around the place. You know, they might do one visit there, then drive a few miles and do another visit, and then a few miles and do another visit. And the first couple of years, we actually saw a 70% increase, would you believe it, of our fuel bill for fire engines, because we were driving around here, there and everywhere.
Right.
So, obviously, you know, we have to take that into consideration. So the approach we use now, we use what we call direct engagement. So you'll identify a street in your station area where you need to hit, and it'll be, again, we'll look at the number of accidental dwelling fires in that area, the demographics, the number of older people, the number of single mums that live in it. And what we'll actually do is we'll go down the day before and we put a leaflet through every door of, on every home on the street. And then we turn up the next day with one or two fire stations and some community safety advocates who are not firefighters, but they wear the same uniform. They support the firefighters and community safety work. And then we'll actually go and just hit that street. So the vehicles hardly move, but you'll just walk the street knocking on doors and doing home safety assessments with people. And it's something that's replicated right across the country.
We're going to take a short break here for a second, Phil, and then we're going to come on back, and because there's a lot more that I'd really like to cover here. So you can just hang on a second during the break.
Okay, no problem.
You're listening to Fire Marshal's Corner on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Ed Camo.
Radio at firehouse.com.
Okay, we're back here on radio at firehouse.com, talking with Philip Hayes, who's the head of community fire services with the Cheshire Fire and Rescue Services over in the UK. And Phil was telling us about their great community outreach that we're doing, and it's just really impressed with what I'm hearing over there. And one of the things that Phil had just mentioned was community advocates that go out with the fire service, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit more if we could, Phil.
Yeah, do you want me to tell you the story of the advocates? Or is that,
sure.
Yeah, I think one of the things we found is as we built up the community safety work that we were doing, which was really mainly the firefighters out there doing the community safety work, is one of the inherent problems with the fire service is that you do get called out to emergency incidents. And very often on occasions where we would have fire engines out in the community working away, and all of a sudden they'd all have to get on the fire engine and they'd disappear to an incident. May not be back for an hour or a couple of hours, sometimes not even at all that day. And there's quite a bit of inconsistency. And when you're actually engaging with the community and you know, you break down that first barrier of actually speaking to the community and getting in with the community and chatting to them, and then all of a sudden you'll jump on your fire engine and disappear, it doesn't leave a very good mark because you think, well, where have they gone and they've not come back to me? A similar thing in schools. We do a lot of school visits where we go into the schools and the fire engine goes to the school and they talk to the young people. And again, what would happen is the fire crews would get a fire call and the fire engine would disappear, and you know, you'd have a class of young children there who were really excited about having the fire engine down and it's gone now. So how do you cover that? So one of the things we've done is we've appointed a number of what we call community safety advocates. And these people, they wear the same uniform as a firefighter. They're not trained to fight fires, but what they do have is skills in community engagement. They have skills working with minority communities. We've got some advocates that are specially trained by social services to work with older people. But what they do is they support the firefighters, so that if the firefighters do disappear to a fire, we don't leave the people with nobody. We've still got some advocates and some still people who don't have to do the emergency response working in that area. And it's the same with the school visits, because they go with the firefighters to the school visits. If the firefighters disappear, then we actually leave somebody in there. And in addition to that, we've got quite a lot of rural areas in Cheshire where we don't have fire crews on duty all the time. They're actually on pages, the retained firefighters, so they're only called for incidents. So we have to think about how we can actually engage with those communities. And, you know, it's not practical to pay to have a fire engine and a crew in an area just to do home safety assessments. You know, I mean, they have to be there for the fire cover as well. So if that appliance is not required for fire cover, then we have to look at other options for doing our community engagement and community safety. And this is where this whole concept of the fire safety advocates came, and it's working really well, and we've got some cracking people who've joined the service, and the, you know, and all they want to do is work with the community for us, and it's really working well.
Now, are they employees of the fire service, or are they volunteers? Or
no, they're employees. Mm-hmm. I've got about 25 advocates working in Cheshire now who are employed by me mm-hmm. full-time. I've got a number of part-time advocates who just do 100 hours a year community work for me, and they get paid for that. But we're also trying to build up the volunteer network, and one of the things I'm really keen to progress is we do have a number of volunteers. We've got about 120 volunteers in the fire service in Cheshire. Now, they're not volunteer firefighters. They're volunteer community workers, and they vary from people who run fire cadet units, because we have a number of fire cadet units across Cheshire. So we have volunteers running those. We have volunteers, and for example, we have a historic vehicle society, and we have volunteers who run that. But we also have volunteers who work with the fire safety advocates and go out in the community and go and help people in the communities. And they volunteer for different reasons. You know, we've got various people volunteer for us. And they go out and help the community. They work with our advocates. Again, we put them in a uniform. We give them the uniform to wear. And they do the same role as the advocates do.
How do the firefighters take this change? Because as we started off with, it was a big change in terms of the culture for the fire service. How did that all go?
Yeah, it is a big change, and it has. And you know, the fire service in the United Kingdom has been on a journey, and you know, some of the journey has not been easy, and it has been challenging for some people. On the whole, though, majority of firefighters have opened their arms, and they've openly accepted it, and they work very well in the community. Just like any organisation, there's always a minority of people that will oppose any change. But it is refreshing to go out there with the crews, and you know, my job, I try and get out there and go and see what the crews are doing. I go and speak to the advocates out on the ground in the field and see what they're doing. And on the whole, it's very positive, and it's really good. The gripes tend to be from your staff tend to be not about what you're trying to do and not about this big community safety picture, but they tend to be about, you know, they haven't been able to order a jacket for working outdoors, and they ordered it a month ago and they've not had it, or they can't get a name badge because they've ordered a name badge. So whereas you'd expect people to be coming back to you and saying, you know, oh, I don't want to do this because it's not my job, I'm a firefighter, and mm-hmm. they do actually see it as their job, and they do some absolute fantastic work out there, and it's all credit to them mm-hmm. that they have taken this on board, and the firefighters do recognise that this is part of the job.
So it really sounds like the fire service has taken the whole prevention effort and elevated it quite a bit, you know, when you look at it in terms of organizationally, from, you know, probably on par with operations, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, there is. I mean, we've got that balance, and I think that, you know, the balance is there, that we, I don't know whether it'd be a 50-50 balance, but there is a split between the prevention and the protection side of the organization. That preventative work was originally done with Community Fire Protection Department, so from a commercial side of things, and the legislative framework for non-domestic dwellings was where we used to focus all our energy in fire prevention. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, we do that in the community as well now. So we have got that balance right. There is some questioning going on at the moment. As you know, we had those four firefighters killed in an incident, sadly, a few weeks ago in Warwickshire. And certainly the representative bodies, one thing they look at is, you know, the balance between the preventative side and the protection side. So, you know, the question will always be asked, have we gone too far down the community safety road, you know? And I think the answer to that for me is a definite no. You know, I think we have got the balance right, and we've proved by the amount of fire deaths that we've reduced that we can do this without it impacting on operational cover, without it impacting on the operational efficiency of the fire service. And, you know, yes, it is important we get the balance right, and like I said, the Warwickshire incident with the four firefighters dying, we'll ask some questions, and the review will look at that, but I'm confident that one of the things it won't do is criticise the amount of community safety work we're doing in the fire service.
And really, that's kind of the bottom line, is how many lives have been saved, and when, if you see the numbers going down, I think that just speaks volumes to the effectiveness of the program you're doing.
Yeah, it does, and you know, we've been doing some analysis just in Cheshire lately, and we've been looking at the number of accidental fire deaths and number of accidental dwelling fires and injuries and the amount of home safety assessments we've done in Cheshire. And I gave you a copy of some documents when I met up with you, with a sort of draft thing that we're pulling together. And when I look at it, I actually see the lines on the graphs. I see the lines for the number of dwelling fires, number of injuries rather, going down, and I see the steep increase in the number of home safety visits that we do. You know, you've got to think that we're actually putting our energies in the right place.
Well, we've been talking with Philip Hayes, who's the head of Community Fire Services with the Cheshire Fire and Rescue Services over in the UK, about their, to us, innovative and really aggressive community outreach program. And really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, Phil.
No, it's been a delight to have a chat with you.
All right. You're listening to Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Ed Camot here on Fire Marshal's Corner.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, today on Radio at Firehouse.com on the Fire Marshal's Corner, joining us is Dr. Jim Marsden, who's with the Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Services over in the UK. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
I met Jim a few weeks ago when I was over in London at the Fire Summit 2007, where he gave an absolutely fascinating presentation on the environmental impacts of fire, which is something that we're just starting to take a little bit of a closer look at here in the United States. So I invited Jim to join us today to give us the sense of what he has learned, what he has discovered, and just share his ideas with us. So with that, Jim, I'd have to say that you are kind of light years ahead of us in terms of what we're looking at when it comes to fire in the United States. What have you come across over there?
I think, Ed, it's just a different way of looking at how the fire services respond within the UK. We sort of move from preventing, prevention and intervention, and perhaps we should be looking perhaps from a more environmental angle. The world at the moment is very much in tune with the effects of global warming and CO2, and fire is just another combustion system which actually leaches CO2 into the atmosphere. And obviously the professionalism of firefighters and obviously risk planning, I'm sure that the fire and rescue services can actually reduce the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted into the air by actually either removing fires or being more efficient in putting fires out.
Now, it's not just carbon dioxide, too. I mean, fires obviously generate a whole bunch of toxins that go into the air and into the ground and into the water.
Yeah, of course. The toxic runoff from firefighting jets and other greenhouse gases such as methane is also present, as well as the nuisance value of soot and other partially combusted materials within smoke plumes. And that is well documented at some recent large fires, both in the UK and Europe, that the effects of fire on the environment can be quite catastrophic indeed.
I think probably one of the things that we struggle with, you'd kind of a line on it, was quantifying this. I mean, sure, you have a house fire or you have a wildland fire, but what kind of impact is this having on the environment? I think that's something that would be invaluable information.
I think at the moment we're in very early stages of actually trying to estimate the size of a fire. It's very, very difficult because obviously the professionalism and the speed of response from fire and rescue units, it isn't consistent. You know, sometimes the fire's kept very small, sometimes fires are kept very, very large. And obviously the longer the fire's burning, obviously the more carbon dioxide and other gases are emitted into the atmosphere. There's been a lot of research into complete combustion, which is gasoline engines and turbines, but obviously incomplete combustion, which fire is, and it's just another branch of combustion, there's been very little research. And obviously over in the UK here, we were prompted by looking at the community fire safety aspect, you know, how we operate in the community. Most fire and rescue services now actually operate within the community, partnerships with local authorities to actually negate the effects of fire. And one of the statistics we looked at was as a result of a joint partnership with other authorities in actually removing fires such as abandoned cars and abandoned rubbish. And then obviously the theory being that if you've removed the rubbish, you've actually removed the source of CO2. So you can actually measure your community protection measures actually in means of reduction of CO2, i.e. you remove the fire, you've removed potential for fire, so therefore you've actually removed the increase in CO2. Now, how to measure that, Ed, is very, very difficult and subject to a lot of debate at the moment due to the fact that the research there that has been done is very limited indeed. And at the moment, we're just trying to get a general feel in orders of magnitude of what the actual effects of fire within the community are. And we must remember, actually, that a fire in Europe is the same as a fire in the US. So hopefully, as the research progresses, the figures that we do come for that should be of worldwide benefit to the whole community.
And understanding that, you know, it is very much in the beginning stages, you did have some some calculation methods that you outlined in your presentation. You know, could you go over those perhaps a little bit? And also, we'll have a link to your presentation on the page here, too, for people to look at. But maybe you can go over it a little bit for us.
Yeah, that's fine. What we tried to do when we looked at the research was actually try to get the order of magnitude of how big the scale of the problem was. And obviously, we took an average of that a fire had been burning for 15 minutes. Within the fire and rescue service that I belong, Greater Manchester, we have an attendance time where we'll attend all fires within 8 minutes, and then I added sort of 1 minute for the call, and then presumed then that the professionalism of the firefighters would take 6 minutes to extinguish. So we took an average time of 15 minutes and basically looked at the statistics for a wide range of fires. And obviously we had to make an assumption with these range of fires to the actual size of them. And obviously in houses and dwellings we confined it to the room of origin, and then for industrial premises we went a lot larger, and for cars we went to a smaller size. And then we estimated the amount of carbon dioxide that was actually given off per second or per minute from the fire. And our results were quite fascinating. And we sort of estimate within the UK that we could be into the low millions of tons of emissions of CO2 from fires. But however, this only gives us a brief snapshot of the scale of the problem. Other fires like large-scale bushfires and wildfires and fires in industrial premises that may burn for many days have not been accounted in for this. So at the moment within the UK, our research now is just sort of beginning to refine the calculation method of how we calculate how much carbon dioxide is emitted for a range of fires. And obviously over the next year and the periods following this, Ed, we hopefully should be able to develop a small model which will allow us to do a desktop exercise to actually study some of the risks within the community.
Now, you say low millions of tons of CO being generated. In the big picture, is that a lot? Is that a little? Is that in the middle of the pack?
I think it's not a significant amount as when looking at transportation issues and the way that we're an oil-driven economy. But again, most initiatives now only need to be very small to make a big difference and a big impact within society. And in fact, now we see many large corporations and many groups actually looking to reduce their output of CO2. And I don't think we can sort of rely on one initiative or one group to actually cut their emissions. I think it's a public responsibility and duty for all services, especially the fire and rescue service, where we tend to be more reactive, to actually get into a more proactive role, to actually, you know, controlling the effects of fire in society.
Now we're talking about the actual fires in terms of generating CO and contributing to global warming. There's a lot of other attendant things as well. For example, the fire apparatus, you know, out there responding, it's generating emissions and things like that. Is that being taken into account as well?
At the present time, we've not looked at that, Ed, naturally follow on from the research that we're doing, because obviously if you can prevent a fire in a building, it sort of affects every other action that the fire and rescue services are there. For example, if we fitted a building with sprinklers or a water suppression system, and we have 100% confidence in that system, we're not going to end up with a big fire there. So therefore, the building becomes sustainable, and should there be a fire outbreak within that building, the fire and rescue service attending would simply be there for a mop-up operation. And if we compared that basically to an operation of an unsprinkled building that may burn for many hours or perhaps many days, the effects of the carbon dioxide from the building and the effects from the burning of diesel fuel and from pumpers or ladders, you know, as needs to be added into the equation. But at this present time, we've not looked at that, but it's a very sound and pertinent point, you know, to take in the effect.
Now, you had also mentioned kind of the key word there, sustainable, because that's another aspect we're starting to look at, too, that something like a sprinkler system contributes to a sustainable community. In other words, you're not using as much water to put out a fire. And what I'm discovering in this country is that fire safety is really not taken into account in terms of a green rating on a building. And I think that's something that's kind of ripe for future action, is the whole concept of a sustainable community. And part of that is avoiding a fire.
Yeah, I agree. I think the sustainable building concept, and there's various codes within the UK now to make more buildings energy efficient and cut down the carbon footprint of a building, is only effective until the building actually catches fire. And traditionally, the use of sprinklers has been for property and life protection, and rightfully so. But obviously now perhaps it's time for a new angle to look at things, to actually fit sprinkler systems and other suppression systems in for environmental reasons. you know, the buildings today are built to be sustainable over a long period, say 50 years, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of good work goes into making these buildings energy efficient and low CO2 emitters of gas and other greenhouse gases. But however, as soon as the building catches fire, that sustainability angle disappears. And obviously, for the period of putting sprinklers in the building, there is an expense of CO2 emissions in actually constructing the materials for the sprinklers. But this is outweighed by the effects that the sprinklers have in the building. Because we've got to remember that there's an amount of carbon dioxide generated when the building is built, i.e. the steelwork and the construction, the heat to make that. And then there's obviously, when there is a fire, the effects of the fire on the building and its contents again puts more CO2. And then once the building's rebuilt or recycled, there's a CO2 issue there. So putting sprinklers in there will make your building more sustainable, less likely to be damaged severely by fire, although we, from history there are fires in sprinkled buildings, and we know from statistics these are kept very small. So therefore, the argument for fitting water suppression systems for environmental reasons is only going to add to the, you know, the sustainability and resilience of the building.
And I remember you using a phrase that I wish I could take credit for, calling a sprinkler an environmental protection system, because that's exactly what it is.
I think it is, at the end of the day. You know, it's, you know, the good work that sprinklers do in buildings and other suppression systems, and we mustn't forget them, you know, in protection of life and property. And the track record that sprinkler systems do have is impeccable. Obviously, now it's a time perhaps to look at a new approach to the use of sprinklers and suppression systems for sustainability. Obviously, sustainability both to the community as well. You know, if we look at the protection of schools, for example, with sprinklers in, if we fit sprinklers for environmental protection as well, you can also say the protection for the community, because most schools today are used by the communities for other reasons other than for schoolwork. And there could be, hopefully, a change in the codes, or it would be nice to have a change in the codes, where buildings could be rated on their sustainability, mm-hmm. I think, which you said in an earlier conversation, that the building would be attractive to developers and the governments. You know, if you fit sprinklers within a building, you know, there'd be an incentive given by local government to say, because you've developed a sustainable building, you know, you could attract financial packages, or you could attract lower rates for the use of that building its first few years. And I think really it would be nice to have an energy efficient building, but also a sustainable building with some sort of measurement on it.
So what's the future of research? What are you looking at? And actually, how is it being done? How's the research being done for the future on this issue?
Well, the research at the moment's being done is in very early stages. The Chief Fire Officers Association now is beginning to start a work stream to look at the effects of this. And I think, firstly, we need to look at how we can accurately measure this, and then hopefully we can apply that to a wide range of fire and rescue services, both metropolitan services such as Manchester and Liverpool and London, but more importantly to the smaller shire brigades, as we call them, you know, to put an accurate figure. And I think the next step then would be to compare the statistics from these fire and rescue services and actually develop a carbon footprint for each type of, you know, fire and each type of fire and rescue service. Coupled with that, after that, then the research then is obviously working with partners in the community. One of the big things is about removal of trash or removal of unwanted waste from within the community. Obviously, if somebody abandons a car there, that car might eventually be set on fire. And obviously, then, if we can remove that, we could remove the source of carbon dioxide. So within Greater Manchester, the research at the moment is trying to estimate an accurate figure of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, but also now to start to spread our research results to other members of the community that we wouldn't normally partner up with, because obviously removal of rubbish and removal of trash is down to other agencies.
Are you familiar with any other countries or fire departments around the world that are starting to take this kind of approach to fire safety?
I've seen a report from the California area, where a lady from one of the universities has done some studies, and she estimated that the recent California wildland fires was in the region of 7 million tonnes of CO2 mm-hmm. at the moment. On other fire and rescue agencies at the moment, from my current research and literature reviews, there has been work done on carbon emissions, but these have been sort of confined to developing green fire stations or developing greener vehicles. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, the actual looking at fires and studying the footprint of a fire has not been undertaken. Mm-hmm. And we must remember that also, to look at buildings within our own community, we need to do research to identify which buildings perhaps present the greatest risk to the community, i.e. large chemical works or large production sites, which may need particular attention and planning by fire and rescue services should a fire occur there, or perhaps developing strategies to mitigate the outbreak of fire should it occur.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Jim Marsden, who's with the Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Services over in the UK, about the environmental impacts of fire, not only wildland but structure fires. And we really appreciate you joining us today, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Fine. It was a pleasure to join you. Mm-hmm.
And there's more information on the webpage here. We have a link to the presentation that Dr. Marsden gave at Summit 2007 over in London. And this really is a growing field, so I'm sure we'll be covering it more in the future. So, my name is Ed Kamau, and you've been listening to Fire Marshal's Corner on radio at firehouse.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.